page 445. As I told many of you on another occasion, anytime you teach the Torah, or for that matter, anytime you teach anything, you cannot teach it the same way on two consecutive years, because you're in a different place, and therefore you see the Torah through different eyes. So I came across an interpretation this year on something that I had taught previously, but something new came to my attention. So therefore, I'm going to repeat a section, but with a completely different interpretation. Page 445, chapter 10, sentence 1. Why don't you begin with that, Donna? Read it loud and clear. So here, in chapter 10, the two sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, each took their pan, and they put in it fire, and they put in it incense in order to give it as a sacrifice, and they brought it before God, and it was called strange fire, which they were not commanded to bring. Now, in order to understand this, before we see what happened, let's go back two or three sentences, because now we have the dedication of the Mishkan, the dedication of the sanctuary. And read sentence 23 and 24, Marlene, on the same page. So the whole purpose of the book of Exodus was to create a sanctuary, and finally, on the eighth day, the sanctuary was completed. They brought their first sacrifice ever to be, and God accepted it, and he blessed the people. And sentence 24. So there was extreme sense of jubilation. The first sacrifice ever to be brought, everything went well, the glory of God shined, fire came out and it ate the sacrifice, and Vayoronu, everyone was extremely happy, and they fell on their faces as an expression of thanksgiving and gratitude, and that there was a real connection with God. So that's the first sacrifice ever to be brought at the completion of the building of the sanctuary. Good question. In other words, why is there a need for sacrifice? And we'll leave. Let me hold that question in abeyance, and we'll get back to that in 5 minutes when I show you something else. So the sanctuary was complete, and they brought a sacrifice, and God accepted it joyfully. Now we go back to the children of Aaron. They brought a strange fire, which they were not commanded to bring. There are a number of interpretations what it means that they were not commanded to bring, and what was the motivation of Nadav and Avihu. Does anyone know any of the interpretations? I'm sorry, yes? Yes. Right. The main interpretation is that there were two leaders. Who were the leaders of the people? Moses and Aaron. Moses was the main leader in terms of one aspect. Aaron was the main leader in terms of the priesthood. And here were younger people. And how do most younger people perceive an elder statesman? As, well, when will their time be over so I can take over? And that's something, for example, that Freud talked about when he talked about sanitists, the whole field of sanitology. That unconsciously there is this wish of sanitology so I can become onto my own once that other person who is the elder statesman is not here. As long as that other person hovers there, I am always in the status of the child. So Nadav and Avihu looked at Moses and Aaron and said, it's my turn, So if this sacrifice was brought by Moses and Aaron and was accepted, now I can bring my sacrifice, even though I was not commanded to bring it, and things will go very well, and maybe I will plant the seed of what? Not of rebellion, but I will plant the seed that I will be the successor. In other words, what frequently takes place in the life of people is 10, 15 years before something takes place, they drop a little seedling. It's very small, it's hardly noticeable, but it was done. It's a certain memo which was written in a certain way to plant an idea, and 5, 10, 15 years later, there will be other small things that take place that eventually the entire thing will take place, and then you look around and you say, I don't know how it happened. Wow, this new person is in charge. But small seeds are always planted. What was the response? Read sentence number two. Dr. Field, sentence number two. Loudly, please. Suddenly, the fire that was supposed to consume a sacrifice, it consumed Nadab and Abihu, and they died before God. One second, please. Just hold your question in abeyance. Sentence number three, Marvin. By those who come too close unto me, I will remain in the category of Kodesh, whatever Kodesh means. Go on. And therefore, by killing Nadab and Abihu, I will also have a sense of kavod, honor, dignity in the people, and they will not try to abrogate the law or deviate from the path that I have indicated. Now, if you interpret this, this has been one of the most perplexing passages in the whole Bible. Here, you do something a little different. You bring a strange fire. Okay, it wasn't commanded. Maybe it should be interpreted as what's called in Hebrew a korban nedava, a voluntary sacrifice. And if it's voluntary, isn't it better that I was not commanded to do this, but I want to do this? So he says, Bikrovai, by those who try to come too close to me and do not remember that there is a distinction between humanity and divinity, and they want to dissolve that distinction, I will remain Kodesh. I will remain holy to such an extent that I will be distinct. Once again, I will show that there is a distinction between humanity and divinity. Nevertheless, after everything is said and done, it's very perplexing what really has been going on. Why did God first accept the sacrifice and then reject the sacrifice to such an extent that he killed Nadab and Abihu? So let me tell you how my mind worked this year. Because I didn't understand it, and it was so major, I said, where else, like you raised the question, Frieda, that's why I held you in abeyance, where else were there sacrifices? So that's how my mind worked. So I went back to the very beginning when sacrifices were first introduced. So I'm going to ask you to turn to chapter 4 in Genesis, sentence number 3, page 14. So in other words, whenever you don't know something, and whenever something is confusing, try to find an early parallel source that deals with something like this, and you'll come up with a deeper understanding of what's going on. Nathan, why don't you read sentence 3, 4, and 5? Loud, please. So what did Cain bring? The first sacrifice, Frieda, ever to be brought in the history of humanity was brought by Cain. He was an agricultural person, and he wanted to bring a gift to God. He wasn't commanded. He just wanted to give a gift, and he gave from the fruit of the land. Go on. And Hebel, his twin brother, brought, he was a shepherd, so he dealt with a different type. He brought the best of his flock, in contrast to Cain, who only brought fruit, but not the best of the fruit. And what happened, Nathan? So God turned to Hebel, which means to the motivation that Hebel did, and to the offering. Go on. So the first time sacrifices were brought, they were brought by Cain and Hebel, Cain and Abel. Cain brought fruit of the land, and it was only an average fruit, because it doesn't say the best. And Hebel brought the very, very best of his flock, and they wanted to say an appreciation and gratitude to God. And God said, I'm only accepting Hebel, and I'm not accepting Cain. And as a result of that, what happened? Fratricide. God didn't do it, but he caused it indirectly by accepting one and rejecting the other. So once again, in the first sacrifice ever to be brought, how does God demonstrate himself? As a form that what really counts? The intent. The intent counts. For example, many times in certain books in Judaism, they say the only thing that counts is the act. They are 100% wrong. And a lot of people who have written like that are my mentors and my friends, but they're 100% wrong. And we see this right here, that God rejects this not because the gift was bad, but the motivation was not what God had wanted. And ultimately, what God wants to indicate by this is that the essence of who you are is not determined by your action, but determined by your intent. And says, God, I know your intent because I can read into your heart. I am what's called in Hebrew a bochein lev, someone who gets into the heart. And therefore, all the secrets of you, I know your secrets. So when you do a certain act, I can look beneath that. Okay. Because the rabbis say the following thing. It's a very good question. I struggled with that question also. By Hebel, it says, Nibucho wrote so no, from the best of his first flock. So the rabbis say that he gave the best of his sheep. While by Cain, it says, Mifri ha'adama, from the fruit of the land. And the rabbis interpret that the fruit of the land means he did not give from the very best. Right, rather than selecting something that was the very special and things like that. Yes, Lillian. There's always a difference between Judaism and how Judaism has been taught. So Judaism frequently has been taught ritualistically and behaviorally to the exclusion of inner intention, but that's not what Judaism teaches. It was really in there. Right. Exactly. Yes, I'm sorry, Dr. Sparrow. I know you like to argue with me, but with God. Right, the first point.
I agree with you.
What Dr. Speier is saying, that Cain deserves some points here, because he was the first person in history to bring a sacrifice. What does that teach you? That when you're in the army, never volunteer. But I understand what you're saying. Yes, that what we say in our prayers, particularly on the holidays, Ish Kamatnat Gado, refers to the amount of charity that we give, not the motivation. Not the motivation. Like, if you give one penny, but the motivation is what I'm going to talk about in a moment, then it's excessive. Each person gives according to the ability of his hand. So therefore, in the first time that the world was created and sacrifice was given, one is accepted, one is rejected, and death comes into the world, and fratricide comes into the world. It's exactly what took place. Later on, when the Mishkan, the sanctuary, was now completed, and let's turn back now, what happened, one is accepted by Moses and Aaron. On page 445, one is accepted, the one given by Moses and Aaron, and then one is rejected by Nadab and Avihu, and once again, death comes into the world, this time directly caused by God. So therefore, what needs to be seen is God is teaching one main purpose that, like, he wants to drill into you till you really get it. And that's why the punishment may seem to us to be very, very not corresponding to the act, and very, very severe, but it's like the main point of all of service towards God and service to other people depends not on the action, but on the motivation that goes with the action. So therefore, let's look at a few examples of a few things. First, let me point out to you one example that Viktor Frankl talks about. He gives a definition of health that I have always found very, very interesting. Does anyone recall what his definition of health is, his analogy? He says the definition of health is when you have eyesight without a cataract. And he says as follows, when you have good eyesight without a cataract, you only see out. When you have a partial cataract or a cataract, you see part of your own eye. And it becomes, in other words, right now my eyesight is good, I only see out. But if I have pathology in my eye, I also see part of my own eye. So Viktor Frankl says the definition of health is when you see out, when you can transcend who you are. And when you focus on yourself, you don't necessarily have a healthy attitude. So let's use that as an example, and the two examples of Cain and Hevel and Nadab and Avihu, and let's see what is going on. We all know that people give gifts. People give gifts. Let's talk about what is the motivation that some people give gifts. Good topic, right? What would you say? Yes, Debbie, what would you say? Yes, one possibility is to express thanks. What's another possibility? To endear themselves to the person. And what would that be based on, Rose? If you want to endear yourself to the person, how do you feel about yourself? Not too good. A need for approval. So there are some people that are very, very generous. And part of their generosity in gift giving is a very, very low self-esteem. And by being very, very generous, I will endear myself. That's partially number one. And what Debbie said is partially number two. Because you really like the other person, and you can want to show gratitude and thank you, and that's also. I understand by some people who have told me on the way certain people do business with, let's say, different Oriental people, Japanese, that's a cultural custom, and that's part of the business culture. What? What's that word? Right, right. It's in Deuteronomy, you're right. Yep. You've wronged them and you want to correct them. Obligation, sense of obligation. Now, let's also talk about the topic of loving another person. What could be different motivations of loving another person? You thought of them? And I was talking more about in a relationship, when you love another person. Some people function with a sense of obligation. Some people, what? You need. All of that, and sometimes guilt, and all of that. All the things which we said about gift giving also applies in terms of that. Now let's go even a deeper level, in the level of intimacy, sensuality, and sexuality. What could be a number of different motivations that take place in this area? Same thing. So what God is teaching us is as follows. In reference to your relationship with God, in relationship with friends, and in relationship with love and intimacy, what actually counts primarily and what is paramount is your inner intention. And when that is right, that produces life. When that is not right, we are told very explicitly that that is the road of self-destruction. Death will come. One second. Death will come either through fratricide, and if you look at most people where there is a type of fratricide, and nowadays, in lieu of fratricide, what do we have? What? Alienation or litigation. I mean, there are a number of people in their 60s and 70s, and maybe they were all involved in some family business, and there's fratricide, although the thought has been there, but there is litigation or alienation and estrangement, and that frequently takes place. So what God is talking about, He's giving us a very clear direction on how to live life in a life-enhancing and life-affirming way. And that is the ability to transcend and not focus on narcissistic aspects of your fragile ego. When you do things like that and you're focused outwardly, it's a tremendous feeling of uplifting and feeling elevated and spiritually enhanced and enriched. However, if everything you do with another person or with God is partially motivated with self-aggrandizement, and you all know, for example, Lawrence Kohlberg in his second level of moral development talks about, and this he considers the second level of moral development, I scratch your back and you scratch my back, and that takes place in the United States Senate and the House of Representatives and in every family and in every community. That is not what the Torah is talking about. What the Torah is talking about is aspects of going beyond yourself and reaching out because you want to reach out because that person deserves something. Right, expecting nothing in return. For example, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, it was a famous story. Reb Chaim lived in a city in Russia, and somebody passed away that was not well known. And he helped, and he did what was appropriate, and they planned the funeral for tomorrow morning, something like that. And an hour later, somebody else passed away in that city, unexpectedly, who was a pillar of the community. And he did what was appropriate, and they were about to plan the funeral, and they said, let's bury the second person first.
but he or she was the pillar of the community. And Reb Chaim stood his ground against tremendous pressure and said, absolutely not. What needs to be done is the first person who dies gets buried first, and so on and so forth. And he wrote about this a little bit, but by doing that, he lived this. Had he done the other, it would have been to deal with aspects of himself and pressure, and he would be, quote-unquote, seemingly liked more because of being recognizing and so on and so forth. So therefore, yes. But let me tell you something, Nathan. Now let me explain something to you on a deep level. What do we put on the doorpost of our home? Yeah, let me do that. Have you ever asked yourself, I'm sorry, what did you say, Lunay? It's from the Ohasa, yes, that's true. Exactly. It's from the first paragraph of the Shema. Why do you think he put a mezuzah on the wall? I mean, had I written the Torah or someone written the Torah and say, you know, the mezuzah should be on your table, and you wouldn't know any different than it should be on the table. Everyone would accept that. Why on the doorpost and on the doorpost of each room? Obviously, God said so. Thanks a lot, Rabbi. What? Yeah, because what's the first word in the mezuzah? Shema. What does Shema mean? To listen. What do most people do when they walk into a room? They talk. The first thing to do when you walk into a room is to listen. To whom? To two things. One is people, the people in the room, because they have been there already. And the second thing to listen to is an expression that D.H. Lawrence used called the whispering of the wall. In other words, walls pick up everything that goes on the inside. They know everything. So you walk into a house, and you have to listen to people, but also listen to the wall. And that wall contains all the secrets and all the motivation and all the aspects of the internal aspect of that person. So therefore, I'm answering Nathan, because you asked a good question. Nathan basically said the same thing that Lillian said. I thought Judaism always put the emphasis on the action. Action is paramount, but only if it's coupled with the proper inner motivation. If not, then the walls pick up the message. You walk into your home, you hear the Shema, you know exactly what's going on. Yes, Nathan. I believe, Nathan, that your motivation in talking is very commendable, and I appreciate that, and I have a sense of what you're trying to say, and on one level I agree with you, but what the Torah is trying to say, the Torah is trying to create a path of most what can be life-enriching. Let's be honest for a moment, okay? Most people are in despair all the time. Most people have a sense of disillusionment all the time. And the reason is because correct action was done, but the motivation and the sincerity and the authenticity and the genuineness and the ability to really be there to your utmost has not been there. And people pick up that second aspect in a very, very significant way. And therefore, just to get back to the Torah text, why
in the first time the world was created, and the first time the sanctuary was created, why was one accepted and one rejected? To teach you for eternity that the importance of giving, of doing, of ritual has to be combined with who you are, your innermost being. If that, then your guf and neshama, then your body and soul are in unity and they really act accordingly. Otherwise, you come across what's known in English as an automaton, acting and behaving, and most people are like that, and that's why there is so much of that other aspect going on. Yes, Marlene. Okay. But just let me clarify the point. The Rambam says there are 8 levels of giving charity. The highest level of giving charity is getting someone a job, and they don't know that you got a job for them. Which means that ultimately, what does that mean? You restore the dignity of the person unto themselves. Therefore, the rabbis say in a beautiful expression, Adam ma'adif kashalo mitisho kabim sel chavero. A person prefers one measure of agriculture that he has put his hands into and dug and planted and fertilized than 9 measures which he gets as a gratitude, because you like what you have done yourself. So in reference to giving of charity, the main aspect of giving charity is to restore a person's dignity. And once a person feels good about themselves, then they can conquer the world. If they feel lousy about themselves, they can't pick up a pencil. Then you have taken away the dignity of that person, and the Gemara gives an example of that. The Gemara, it's interesting, Nathan. The Gemara gives that example. The Gemara says, let's say someone comes to you and you have nothing to give. Well, what should you do? The Gemara gives a brilliant answer. You should treat him and talk to him and engage him as if you have something to give. And the person wants to be respected. There was an article in the LA Times that there was a certain person, I think it was a woman, who pretended to be homeless. She went to downtown Los Angeles and she pretended to be homeless. And what she noticed, that some people gave her some money, some people took a quick look and then turned around, but she was never looked at and engaged. And what's interesting about that is that on a certain level, everyone in this room is homeless. Everyone. We have a home, could be in Brentwood, Bel Air, Beverly Hills, North, South, wherever. But on a different level, we're all homeless. And the question is, can you go deep enough within yourself to recognize that you are homeless and you share that with that person? How do we know? How do I know that we're all homeless? How do I know that? Which holiday tells us that we're all homeless? Right after Yom Kippur, Vayaronu, I'm happy, all my sins are forgiven. I'm a sense of catharsis and purification. I'm fantastic. 5 days later, I live in a Dirat Arayi. I live in a temporary dwelling. And that's why I know we're all homeless. Because ultimately, the home that everyone has is the heart and feeling within themselves. Yes, Mark. Price is received. Yes. No, I'm just saying his sacrifice was received, and Cain, whose sacrifice was not, gets extremely angry, and and killed him. Interestingly, look on page 14 for a moment. There are certain sentences in the Torah which are very, very difficult. And there's one sentence, which is sentence number 7, that the simple interpretation of that sentence is very difficult. So why don't you read that sentence out loud, Mark, in English? And interestingly, this sentence has been picked up by Christianity as a reference to eventually certain aspects of Christian teaching. And it's a very difficult sentence. Hallo, im teitiv se'eit, if you do well, you will bear it. V'im lo teitiv, la petach hatat roveit, sin is lurking at the door all the time. It's not that man is condemned or he's born into sin, as the next interpretation has gone, but la petach hatat roveit is no matter what you do behaviorally, sin is lurking at the door depending on your motivation. And that's the meaning of that sentence, and that's why that sentence is so difficult. And that's why it's open to this double interpretation. But ultimately, v'atatim shalbo, you have the wherewithal to overcome that. Yes. What's your suggestion? You volunteer. What's your... Okay. I didn't understand what you said. I'm sorry. I paid attention, but I didn't understand. Right. That's excellent. You said that well. What Diane said basically, to be aware of the presence of God in all things that happen, as well as to be aware of the humanity where that takes you, which is a very difficult place to be. Intense consciousness. Allie? Yeah, that's not an easy thing to do, and maybe that's why people had a little difficulty. Allie? And I'm saying something else. I'm saying something a little bit more intense. What I'm saying is that a lot of people do good acts, and that's very nice, but there's a danger that lurks in that. And the danger that lurks in that, it could lead to the path of self-destructiveness, either within yourself or with other people, because the first word of the mezuzah is the Shema, and other people know and hear exactly who you are. There is the lies you tell yourself, also you tell the walls, and also you tell the other people who listen, who have that ability. And that is why the mezuzah is put there, and that's why it's so dangerous. And what you said is a very intense thing, and not many people are able to really do that. But that's really the goal. Marvin? Very good. In other words, proper motivation, even if there is a slightly... And where do we have that, by the way, in the Torah? Does anyone know the expression? It's a very unusual expression. I taught it once last year. It's called Avera Lishma. You do a violation, you do a sin, but you do it with a sense of the presence of God. And where do we see that in the Torah? In the, one of the most obvious places that I talked about? The relationship, also that, but the relationship between Tamar and Yehuda. Tamar and Yehuda had an illicit relationship, and from that union, the Messiah is born. The form of that. And that's why people take different paths and things like that, but really what the motivation was. Yes. No, I disagree with that. Okay. Yeah, minchas. Just modify one aspect of what you said. The person who gives, obviously the person who receives has received something nice, but the person who gives, without the right motivation, there is aspects of self-destructiveness that are planted, and it's very, very dangerous. Now, Let me just go now a step further, okay? Let's take certain mitzvot that most of you actually do. Let's say a recent mitzvah, Passover Seder. I would assume that most, if not everyone, was at some Passover Seder. What is the meaning of a Passover Seder? It's ultimately the process of redemption, to go out of Egypt. Not only to tell the story, but to go out of your own Egypt and to go into a process of redemption. Well, why were you at a particular Seder? Why did you go to that Seder? Was there a genuine aspect of personal or collective redemptiveness? What was your motivation in that? So although we're not that connected with Cain and Abel, or with Nadab and Avihu, in every religious act we do, we have the same question. Well, let's say some of us may go to synagogue. Why do you go to synagogue? Why do you go to that synagogue? Is your motivation really to be with God? Or who do you sit next to, you get some good business advice, you know, depending on what actually takes place in most synagogues. And these questions of Cain and Hevel and Nadab and Avihu apply to all of us on a regular basis as we perform mitzvot. So therefore, the goal of studying this at the creation of the world and at the creation of the sanctuary, of the temple, of the Mishkan, is to give you an exploration. But you have a choice in life. And that choice is being honest with who you are in the innermost being. To the extent that you can be conscious and aware of that, that is uvachat v'chayim. You have chosen life. To the extent that you live a life of bifurcation and creative dissonance, then it could be very, very destructive. So that's the challenge for all of us. Yes.
Thank you.